I said to you the very first week that God is seeking people who are willing to be seen as distinct among men. I think the church at large we're like a pendulum. We're constantly swinging from one direction to the other direction. And I think we went through a number of years, people named it certain things, where we wanted to make sure that the world did not feel awkward around us. Or we wanted to make our worship services, we wanted to make our just kind of the way we relate to people non-threatening and those kinds of things. And there's a place for that. There's a place for us to make sure that we're doing the best job that we can to not build walls between people, right? But in the process of doing that, we dare not lose our distinctiveness. Because God is seeking a people who he could call his own, and they would look different than the world around them. I said to you, as people, as Christians, as believers, our distinctiveness does not come from the clothes that we wear or the length of our hair. It comes from the biblical worldview that we are to possess. In other words, we should be thinking different, behaving different, and it should all be resounding from how we see things, how we see God, how we see the world around us. And in light of our worldview, it should produce a distinctiveness about us. We spent the first couple of weeks laying out the differences between a biblical worldview and a secular or worldly worldview. Simply put, a biblical worldview has God at the center, and a secular or worldly worldview has self at the center. This past week on Tuesday morning when we had gathered for prayer, there was a number of us there, obviously, and one of the gentlemen that was there is by the name of Brandon Pice. He just spontaneously read from a passage of Scripture in James chapter 1, verse 27. This is what it read. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after the orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. I was reminded, I went back to my office a little bit later in the morning and I was looking at that verse again, and I had mentioned to you, I think on week one, about what religion is. And I suggested to you the best definition for religion is the belief or worship of God. So here we hear James saying, religion that God the Father accepts or sees as distinct or embraces is, he gives the example here of looking after orphans and widows. And one may ask themselves, why would he use that as an example? Because at that point in time, orphans and widows were like at the bottom rung of society. You could use anybody at any time that is at the bottom rung of society, because when you are serving those at the bottom rung of society, there's nothing they can do for you. It is totally selfless. There is nothing about that kind of ministry that is self-referential, meaning I'm doing this so that I can derive a benefit from it. Much of ministry that goes on, sadly, is very self-referential. We do it expecting something in return. But James said what God is looking for, he's looking for people who will serve others selflessly. And when he says here, this is what God's looking for, he says, ministry to the bottom rung of people and to not be polluted by the world. Now, a lot of times we talk about being polluted by the world. We think, I shouldn't be visiting prostitutes. I shouldn't be drinking too much. I shouldn't be doing drugs. I shouldn't be viewing pornography. We think of all these items that people could get polluted by. What I'm suggesting to us, the greater pollution that we need to be concerned about is having ourselves on the throne. That is, you know, in our culture and society, we can't go hardly past the day without seeing in the news about this intense pressure for us to go green, right? We got to go green. We got to go green or else we're going to die in 10 years from now, right? Day in and day out, we're bombarded by this. I would suggest to you that it is more important for us as followers, as distinct followers of God, it's more important that we're concerned about going spiritually green and worrying about that pollution than what's in the air. That's in my opinion. You can do with that whatever you want, right? Going green spiritually. Now, I've said this, it was on a slide, I think I have it on a slide again for you today, that the reason why our worldview is so important is because it affects what we believe, it affects what we think, and ultimately will determine how we live. I want to talk to you for the next number of weeks, next 2 or 3 weeks, I want to talk to you about what it is we believe. What it is we believe. And I want to start at ground zero with that. I realize some of you are here, and what I'm going to share with you this morning, you've already got that well established in your heart and soul. But I'm also aware there may be some people here this morning who are waffling on this particular topic. I want to talk to you. I'm calling what I want to share with you today a biblical worldview is a supernatural worldview. A biblical worldview is a supernatural worldview. And to start that discussion, I want to talk to us this morning about this belief, the belief that God exists. Amen. The belief that God exists. Now, in order for us to understand where we are at today, it would be helpful for us to take a quick look back at history. Where we are at today in our culture did not start yesterday, last week, or even last year. It didn't start with the last political cycle. It started way, way, way before that. I'd like to take us back for just a moment to the mid-1500s. That would be what? 500 years ago. Well, just roughly speaking, 500 years ago. Prior to the mid-1500s, the belief in the supernatural or transcendent, which means beyond the natural, was everywhere. Everybody believed in the supernatural. Everything that went on in culture and society took place under the understanding that there was something supernatural, something beyond us, right? It was understood and assumed that there was this continuous relationship between the supernatural or transcendent and the immanent, meaning what we're dealing with right at the moment. Always a relationship going on there in that realm. The supernatural was taken for granted. There was social reinforcement during that period of time. You may, if you think back to the medieval days, one of the catchwords during that period of time was enchantment, or things were enchanted. People believed in the supernatural world. But in the mid-1500s, something took place that's been labeled the scientific revolution. And if you couple that with what happened a couple of hundred years later during the 1700s called the Enlightenment, if you take those two things and you couple them together, a shift took place in the world, not just in our culture, but in the world. And that which was understood previously as taken for granted was now being undermined. This whole idea of the supernatural was undermined. And what came into being was something called naturalism. Naturalism. Naturalism, simply put, is the belief that the natural world is all there really is. Are you still there? Okay, I'm just checking. With this shift, man became his own self-sufficient island of reason, able to know what we need to know without the need for the supernatural. With this shift toward human reason, the supernatural became no longer viewed as believable or necessary. This now has become the default view of the secular worldview. Belief in a transcendent God is no longer believable or necessary. And even if someone, I'm sure you've ran into people like I do, they call whatever they perceive as being supernatural the big guy. The big guy. The big guy upstairs. And even if people tend to subscribe to there being something beyond just the natural of what we can see, it has no meaningful impact in their life. In other words, they might believe in something out there, but that is not taken into it's not taken into their being in terms of making choices and decisions in life. You know, it's a big guy. It's a big guy up there. You know, people, especially in dealing with me, I don't know, I guess this is just cultural, but, you know, when they get around somebody that's a pastor or a priest or something like that, you know, hey, can you talk to the big guy for us? You know, I don't know. There's just that kind of lingo that goes on out there. But even if they subscribe to that level of understanding in the supernatural, it has no meaningful impact in their life. They don't wake up every morning going like, hey, big guy, what's going on? What are we doing today? It only comes up when they're in a certain setting or in a certain circle. Now, because of that being the predominant view that you and I are living with, working with, rubbing shoulders with people that have that understanding or don't necessarily subscribe to a supernatural worldview, that brings a certain amount of pressure to bear on us. I said to somebody, I mentioned pressure here a couple of weeks ago, and somebody texted me afterwards or emailed me and said, you know, you can't believe the pressure that I feel in light of the things you're talking about. Here are some of the ways that pressure is brought to bear. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's not so subtle. But here are five ways we are dealing with this view of naturalism or the natural being all that there is. Here are some ways. Number one, religion is anti-reason, anti-science, and anti-evidence. Anybody ever heard that before? Like what you believe is not, it's against those things, right? What this says to us is, in other words, if you believe in the supernatural, you are against reason, science, and evidence. You know, you're not looking at the things that are plain as a nose on your face, right? And what they're suggesting is that you can't do both, that those two things are decoupled from one another, and you're not able to somehow look at science, reason, and evidence and yet still believe in God. And I'll get to more of that in just a minute. Number two, religion is an emotional crutch. The reason you subscribe to a biblical worldview is you need it for an emotional crutch. This assumes that there is no intellectual reason whatsoever for a person to have a supernatural worldview. It implies that there is something wrong with us, right? You got problems and you hold on to this belief in God because you have to have something to hold on to, right? And that's what we're told. We're told those kinds of things. Number three, religion is childish. Childish. Childish beliefs are those things that you had when you were a kid, but when you grew up and got mature, you stopped believing. Right? Now, for the sake of the adults in the room that still adhere to a big fat guy in a red suit, I'm not going to dispel any childhood beliefs here this morning. But what this implies is that the intellectually mature, for those who are intellectually mature, they have to leave behind their childish beliefs. Number four, religion is the result of brainwashing. You are here this morning because you have, by someone or something, been brainwashed, right? What you believe is false, it's wrong, and you've simply been brainwashed. And then finally, number five, religion is harmful. This is the thought that's out there that you and I are contending with. And the first four that I mentioned to you are aimed at pointing out our lack of rational thoughts. But this fifth one is a pressure that aims at getting us to believe that subscribing to a supernatural worldview is harmful not only for us, but it's harmful for the people that are around us. So we must stop believing in this way, and if we did, society would be a lot better off. If everybody just stopped believing or having a biblical worldview or a supernatural worldview, society would be much better off. Now, one of the things I wanted to draw out here this morning and talk to you about, and one of the ways that this naturalistic kind of reasoning has an impact on us, has a way of potentially polluting us, right, is how you deal with this one question. Why do you believe in God? Why do you believe in God? Now, if your only answer to that is, well, I just know he's there. Or if your answer to that is, I just feel his presence, right? Those are, for those of us who have encountered God personally, those are really good reasons to believe in God. But they are incredibly subjective. Do you know what I mean by that? I mean, what kind of evidence do I have for, I just know he's there? Or I just feel his presence. And when you say that, the other guy that just asked you that rolls his eyes, right? Because it's incredibly subjective. Now, I'd like to suggest to us this morning that there is plenty of objective evidence for why God exists. Plenty. And I take you, now somebody would say, well, you can't take people to a Bible verse because they don't believe in the Bible. I'm not taking you to this Bible verse so that you will quote it to the person who asked you that question. I'm going to this Bible verse so you can see that even if you don't quote this Bible verse, it speaks to us of the evidence, okay? So here it is. Romans chapter 1, verse 20 says this. I think I have it. Yeah, it's there on the screen. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, and divine or supernatural nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Okay? Now, again, I'm not asking you to write that verse down. It would be good to memorize it, but I'm not asking you to memorize it for the purposes of regurgitating it back to the person who may ask you that question. I'm giving you this verse, or I'm referencing this verse, so that we can spend a few moments of using what Paul said is clear evidence that God exists, right? That's what I just read to you. Paul says, since the beginning of creation, there is clear evidence that God exists. Now, I'm going to give you, for those of you who are taking notes, I'm going to give you three solid lines of reasoning based on that verse I just read to you for holding a supernatural view of God's existence. Did I lose anybody? I'm about to, okay? I'm about to lose you. You're going to get lost here, but I'm going to lose you, and then I'm going to find you really quick, right? All right? So number one, I got to wet my lips so I can pronounce this word. Cosmological reason, number one. Okay, it's right there for you. Cosmological. Remember I told you I'd lose you. I lost you right there. I'm gone. You're gone. Cosmos is the Greek word for world. That's all it is. And this is really simple. I'm going to make this so simple for you that even a caveman can get it. All right? All right. So here it is. You ready? Underneath this sound, reasonable explanation for God's existence, the cosmological reason, A, the universe began to exist. Somebody say, yes, it did. Yes. The universe began to exist. Now, even a naturalist, an atheist, a person with a secular worldview would agree to that. They would say, yes, I believe the world began to exist. Okay, so that brings us to B. B is everything that begins to exist has a cause. Has a cause. Everything. This water bottle, right? This water bottle, this didn't show up, right? Somebody actually caused this water bottle to show up, right? They made this water bottle. You with me? Okay, so we've got the universe began to exist, and then B, everything that begins to exist has a cause. And again, even a naturalist, a secular, non-supernatural worldview person would agree to that. They would say, yes, I agree. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Which brings us to letter C. Therefore, the universe must have a cause. Right? I'm finding you again. I lost you. Now I'm trying to find you again, right? So everything that exists has a cause. And you may be saying right now, I came to church to hear this. What? Of course, right? But that is incredibly important. And I'm going to tell you why that's so incredibly important. Because cause could not just be anything. Okay, the earth has been caused to exist. But that cause can't be just anything. Here's what I have in my notes. In order to create space, time, and matter, you still with me? The cause would have to be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial, and uncaused itself. Let me explain. Let me explain. Naturalists would say what caused things to happen was an incredible explosion of two atoms that collided with either. I've got the resident. Okay, I'm okay, right? And I think they put a TV show after what they call it. They call it the Big Bang Theory, right? Boom. And all this happened, right? Now, the only problem with that, there's a huge problem with that. I don't know if you see it yet. The only problem with that is, where did the atoms come from? Where did that? Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you're going to have something that has space, time, and all that stuff, something that is absent of that has to have brought that about. Now, for those who subscribe to a supernatural worldview, a biblical one, the answer to that is found in four words. In the beginning, God. You there? The second line of reasoning, for the existence of God is design. The design reason. This reason states that the complexity and specificity we find in what is created had to have had an intelligent designer. Had to. All the enormous detail we see in nature had to have someone cause that to be that way. It could not have happened by a chance process. Now, a number of years ago, some of you have been around here long enough to remember this, but for a number of years, we had a trauma surgeon that practiced at ECMC attend our church. His name was Dr. Siffring. And they were here for 4 or 5 years, I would say, and then he left his practice at ECMC and moved to Minnesota. Minnesota. But the reason I mention him is because during the period of time that he was here, he was also very instrumental in the beginning stages of DNA research, right? DNA research. And so quite often they would have us over to their home and we would talk about stuff that was mostly way over my head. But there was a few things I picked up in our time we spent with him. And one of them was, he said, I remember him saying, Jeff, when people, if they really understand how we are made, it is a complete game changer in the way that people will see things and look at things. And he said to us at this point, he said, you know, I have some of my colleagues that ask me the question, they're naturalists, they have a secular worldview and don't necessarily subscribe to the supernatural. And they would ask him, they'd say, you know, now that you're seeing all this, doesn't it get you to even further disbelieve there is a God? And I remember what Dr. Siffering said to me when we were talking about this. He said, Jeff, it's the exact opposite. When I see the incredible complexity of even that the fact that every cell in the human body has a trillion codes in it that direct the processes of the body, how could you not believe that God exists? It would take more faith to believe that by chance this happened than to believe in the supernatural. Now, another matter that coincides with this in regards to the existence of God is what's called the fine-tuned earth argument. That everything is not just about our human bodies, but about the atmosphere that you and I find ourselves living in, that it's so fine-tuned that that it had to have had some kind of intelligent designer to it. Like for example, the gravitational pull is just so that if it was more or less, it wouldn't allow for life to exist as we know it. Like our solar system is utterly fine-tuned so that, you know, did everybody see the full moon this morning? Everybody was up early? Thing was huge. It was beautiful. Anyways, everything is just set in place in such a way, and for those who subscribe to naturalism, they would say, well, that just happened by chance, right? That just came about. I found this week. I'm not telling you this so that you'll go out and buy a lottery ticket, but I have to show you this, right? Because when I saw it, it's like, gee, maybe I should try the lottery sometime. Anyways, if you were to buy a ticket, I'm not recommending, don't leave here today and say, Pastor Jeff said to go get a lottery ticket. That's not what I'm saying. But if you were to go when it's at $1 billion, when you're playing for $1 billion in the mega lotto, right? I am told that you would have a 1 in 3 million chance of winning. I'm sorry, 300 million. I did math in Pennsylvania, so forgive me. A 1 in 300 million chance of hitting the jackpot, right? All right. So I got to give you this guy's name, so if you want to look it up, you can. And so that's your chance of winning $1 billion, right? So there's a guy by the name of Hugh Ross. He is an astrophysicist, and he has, and how they do this, I do not know. I just read it. He's an astrophysicist who has crunched the numbers, right, about what the probability. Now, this is just about the design part. This is just about the incredible design of our system, right? He says the chance of that happening is this, right there. So it's 1 with 283 zeros after it, right? I put it on paper. I'm writing zero. My hand got tired writing the zeros from the chance that this happened by accident, by chance, right? Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Dumb and Dumber. All right. But the part of the movie I want to draw your attention to is when he's hot on this lady, right? And she said, the scene, can you picture it? It's Jim Carrey. He's talking to this lady, he looks stupid, and he's talking to this lady, and he's thinking he's got a chance with her, right? And she says, you remember? He says, there's no, she says, there's no chance. And he's standing there, and she said, he's like, what do you mean? Like 1 in 100? And she's like, no, like 1 in 1 million. And he gets this smile, and he says, so there's still a chance? so you're telling me there's a chance? And he goes, yeah! I mean, to me, when I look at that, it's like, that movie has that name of that movie's got lots of implications there. So you're telling me there's a chance. The most reasonable argument is four words. In the beginning, God. Reasonable. Third line of reasoning. We're almost done. For the existence of God is morality. Morality. This line of reasoning points us to the idea of conscience. Conscience. Conscience is defined as the inner sense viewed as acting as a guide to the rightness or wrongness of one's behavior. The conscience. Even an atheist or a naturalist would suggest or say that they have a conscience. When Paul was writing to the Romans in chapter 2, he's making this argument about all of us being in need of Jesus, right? But as he's making this argument, he's saying, you know, the Jews got a download from God of what's right or wrong. But as he's making the argument, he said, the Gentiles never got that download from God, and yet even they know right from wrong. That's what he says. And he says this. This is in chapter 2, verse 15. This proves, I'm reading scripture. This proves that the conscience is like a law written on the heart of man. Now, unfortunately, this thing we call the conscience, it's possible to disregard it. It's possible to resist it. It's possible for it to become hard, or even the Bible talks about it being seared, and people no longer are able to use it as a reliable source of guidance. The issue is, and the reason I'm bringing this up is, where did that come from in human beings? You know, we're told that after the atoms exploded and some kind of molecule life started to form in some pond someplace, and that all this evolution took place, the question is, at what point did the conscience come into man? I mean, it's not a good argument to me, but you could make the argument of going from Timmy the tadpole to, you know, Johnny the jock. But where did the conscience, where did that come from? How did that come about in these molecules? Did it happen in the explosion? Or could it be that God stamped it? When he breathed the breath of life into man in the beginning, and it tells us that man became a living soul, that makes more sense to me that that's when it got put in than at any other time. There is plenty of well-thought-out evidence that God exists. A person is not dumb or dumber or emotionally broken to have a supernatural worldview, to believe that God exists. The belief that God exists is really, really, really good news. I'd like you to consider the following. If we subscribe to naturalism, here is what a person is left with. Human life is an accident with no objective purpose or meaning. Humans are simply chemicals, specks of chemical in a vast and indifferent universe with no more inherent value than a rock. No one should live any particular way because it makes no objective moral difference. And for that matter, there's no such thing as objective right or wrong, so we can't condemn even the worst behavior as decisively wrong. On the other hand, because there is a supernatural creator, designer, and moral giver, human life is a purposeful creation with objective meaning and value given to it by its creator. What does that mean? You may be saying, what does that mean? That means we matter. Simply put, we matter. You matter. Your life matters. Your choices matter. How you live matters. Everything matters because we're not just an accident of space and time. This should cause all of us to be elated. We have purpose and meaning. And like Jim Carrey on Dumber and Dumber, I have to say, yeah. That's awesome. Well, as I said in the beginning, we're going to share in the Lord's table together, and I'm going to invite the elders if they'll make their way forward. And Scott, you are here. Okay, great. Ask the worship team if they'll come back to the platform. And as you all know who come here regularly, you know that when we share in the Lord's table together, we usually have some kind of focus beyond the fact that he died for us and gave his life for us. We have some kind of focus that causes us to have, you know, a focused meaning on a given week. And I just want to remind us before we share in it together that when Jesus first shared in this meal together with his disciples, there was a lot going on. You know, a lot of times we only read from the passage that talks about what he did with the bread and the cup. But there was a whole lot going on at this meal. You may remember John tells us one of the first things that happened is as they were coming together, Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Yeah, that happened on that occasion. He washed the disciples' feet. It was his ministry to widows and orphans in that moment. There was nothing they could do for him in light of what was coming. Also at that same event, Jesus predicted Jesus' betrayal and Peter's denial. Those happened at that supper. We read in John's gospel that after that, after saying that about Peter and telling Judas that he's the one, obviously the rest of the guys needed to hear something more encouraging, right? This isn't looking good. So Jesus begins to comfort his disciples. And the first words out of Christ's mouth are this: if you believe in God, believe also in me. He challenged them to have a supernatural worldview. He called them to get that down, to get that basic tenet down. Believe. Believe. They said, again, in that setting, as he's talking about this with them, the disciples said, Lord, show us the Father. Show us God. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen God. You've seen the Father. Believe me, he says in verse 11, believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the miracles I've done. Today, as we come to the Lord's table, I want us to see this as a fresh moment to say, I believe. I believe. I believe. As we sang earlier, I believe in God the Father. I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe in the Holy Spirit. I believe in the existence of God. Maybe you're here today and you're in a place in life where you're just seeking. You're trying to find some answers about things. Today, if you're here and you're in that place, I want to encourage you to believe. I want to encourage you to simply believe. Don't let the pressures of this secular world push out or put unnecessary doubt in your heart. Listen, from what I've just shared with you today, it makes more sense to believe in God than it does the other stuff they're putting forth. I'm reminded, I know the hour is late, but I'm reminded of a story that when some missionaries were trying to translate John 3:16 into the native tongue of the culture they were serving, they were struggling, trying to find the word in their language that would best capture the idea of belief. And one day as they were out in the jungle or the bush there, they came to a vine bridge that went over a cavern. And the native people, obviously, they knew the bridge. They had crossed the bridge many times. And they hopped right out on the bridge and started to make their way to the other side. And the missionaries, the Wycliffe missionaries, said, whoa, wait a minute. We're not getting on that bridge. And in their native tongue, they said to the missionaries, put your whole weight on it and come across. At that very moment, they said, that phrase they just used, that's what we need to use for what it means to believe. To put the weight of your life on Jesus and come across. Trust. Trust in God. Trust also in me. We believe, Lord. We believe in the supernatural. We believe you are. I heard a man once say, a very smart man, he said, there's a reason why they call us believers. Because our job is to believe. This morning, as we share in the Lord's table together, we're reaffirming, or maybe for some affirming, for the first time. We believe. We believe in the existence of God. And in this case, we believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God.